in the 1250 BCE, the jubilee year of Ramses II, the builder. At dawn, on the appropriate date, in a deeply religious event reminiscent of Newgrange, the sun rays will have fallen on the three statues in the temple's inner sanctuary, two of solar deities, Amun-Re and Re-Oraktri, and one of their earthly representative, Ramses II himself. The fourth statue of the underworld god Ptah remains untouched. Thus, we assume, will be heavenly, will the heavenly life living, giving power of the sun have been harnessed in the service of the earthly state. Considering all the evidence, Ed Crump concludes that the service of the earthly state, there was probably a shift from the old kingdom, when temples may have been oriented like pyramids to the cardinal points to the new kingdom. New solstice alignments seem more likely. Also, solar chapels are mainly on the north sides of temples, while mortuary chapels are generally on the south. And winter solstice sunrise take place in the northeast, and winter solstice sunrise in the southeast. Then the northeast may be a place for renewal, and the southeast may represent a place of light, triumph over darkness.
Dressed in shining armor, he wanted to obey.
Recent statistical analysis has for the first time demonstrated the alignments of Egyptian temples, but has reminded us the land is as important as the sky. The orientations of temples in the south indicated that their gates tended to face the Nile, and the primary solar orientation, similar to our current understanding of megalithic sites in northern Europe, was to the winter solstice. The sun god may have been the presiding deity of the Egyptian cosmic state, comparable to Shamash in Babylon, but there is clear contrast with Mesopotamia, where, to judge from the number of omens devoted to it, the moon seen steadily assuming a greater prominence. The moon was represented in the Egyptian celestial kingdom by Thoth, who was pictured either as an Ibiza-head man surmounted by a crescent moon or as a dog-headed ape, a strange combination which perhaps represents the union of two archaic traditions, strictly speaking. Thoth was the guardian of the moon, which was described as the left eye of Horus, and always needed defending from the monsters of darkness on its nocturnal journey. As did the sun. As an ally of Isis and Horus in the struggle against Set, he became Osiris, chief minister, and was charged with measuring time, much like the Babylonian god Sin. His importance was recognized when the first month of the year was named in his honor, Thoth. A host of other talents were the natural consequence of Thoth's abilities to count and measure. He was the clerk, herald, and arbiter of the gods, resolving disputes between them and announcing Osiris' verdict on the dead. Kept a complete inventory of all natural resources and property, and invented every one of the arts and science, including surveying, medicine, and music. It was Thoth who, by speaking, brought apparently inanimate objects to life. Thoth also invented writing, and therefore magic. The reason why the one implied the creation of the other is simple. Words contain the power of the beings. Ideas or objects that they represent. Which is why the text we find on the inside of the tomes are interpreted less as prayers to gods to accept the soul of the deceased than a form of magical technology designed to facilitate the soul's journey to the Duat. This was an understanding of the way language works, which lasted well into the European Renaissance and still survives in esoteric tradition such as the Jewish Kabbalah. In short, Thoth had complete knowledge and wisdom, which is why the Greeks were later to identify him not with the moon, but with their Hermes, the teacher of divine philosophy and god of the planet Mercury. There appears to have been other moon gods apart from Thoth. Probably the heirs to pre-dynastic regional traditions. One was Seshat or Seshata, Thoth's consort and collaborator in many of his functions, such as writing and record keeping. She was also known as the mistress of the House of Architects, in which role she helped the king to determine the axis of a new temple with the aid of the stars, making out the four angles of the building with stakes. Not unlike the Sumerian Nanshe, the coincidence of two celestial temple buildings, goddesses, made point to an early tradition of female astronomers. We do not know she was previously, or that we don't know if whether Seshet was invented to be Thoth's partner or whether she was previously independent goddess who was linked to him in the process of syncretization, which may have accompanied the consolidation of the Old Kingdom. The Theban god Khonsu, or Khonskensu himself, appears to have been a regional lunar deity who only assumed national popularity when Thebes became the capital of the New Kingdom after around 1570 BCE. His name is derived from the verb to cross over, giving the word the meaning he who traversed the sky. Like the sun, he traveled across the sky in a bark. Khonsu had a timekeeping role, like Thoth, but without the latter's political power. So the 9 months of the year, Pachon, does seem to have been named after him. With his prominence in the New Kingdom, he became renowned as a healer and exorcist under the name Khons-Or, and was represented as a man with the falcon's head surmounted by a disc in a crescent moon. He never though came close to equaling the sun's political authority, which reached its highest point in the reign of the controversial new kingdom pharaoh Akhenaten, the glory of Aten. Akhenaten originally came to the throne as Amenophis IV. Amen is satisfied. Named after Amen or Amun, the supreme god of the priesthood of Thebes, the new kingdom capital. Early in his reign, he instituted a religious reformation in which the cult of Re Arachte was set up as a direct rival to Amun and was represented by the Aten or Aton of days, that is the solar disk, whence issues the light of the day. He was not content though to favor the sun in a particular form and was determined to suppress the worship of gods other than Re Arachte manifested in Aten. And it is this that is responsible for the myth that he was a proto-monotheist. However, that he saw himself as the earthly part of a trinity consisting of Re Arachte, the primordial god. The primordial god and father, and Aten, his physical manifestation in the sky. This suggests that his theological break with previous pharaoh was far from substantial, that he constructed a new capital at Akte Aten, Orison of Aten, and that only he was allowed to worship using religion to attack the power of the priesthood in the style of many Roman emperors. Manipulation of solar religion to maintain their power, even if his beliefs were utterly sincere. that Atmung had already been syncretized with Encontre's political centralization to unify and simplify the pantheon. That indicates that his revolution did not come out of thin air, but it was part of a struggle between political power centers, the court and the temple, and evolving cosmologies. Egypt, the stars and the soul. Hereditary prince and count, soul companion, wise in the sacred writings who observes everything observable in heaven and earth, clear-eyed in observing the stars. The Egyptian sky was at one with the land and life on earth, flourishes all the more if it was harmonized with life in the heavens. The belief that the Egyptians did not possess a precise mathematical astronomy in the modern sense is strictly correct, but misses the point that the sky provided a set of visual images which provided meaning for life on earth, as well a series of structures and living beings which enable auspicious moments of time to be identified, the states to be managed, and souls to travel through space. As such, divisions of the sky were both particular and imbued with numinous significance. The whole sky was divided into constellations. The most important group were the 36, which are generally known to us by the Greek word decan. Though they were known to early Egyptologists as diagonal calendars, or more properly, star clocks. These were used to record the time, a critical process if nocturnal religion rituals were to be conducted at the divinely sanctioned moments. They make their appearance in drawings and texts on 12 coffin lids surviving from the 10th dynasty onwards before 2100 BCE, perhaps by 2400 BCE, and may have been the result of deliberate invention, similar to the Old Kingdom calendar reform, rather than a long evolution. What we find are 36 constellations listed graphically in 36 columns and 12 lines, each arranged in diagonals. Detailed illustrations of the 36 decans also appears on the astronomical sailing of Senmut around 1433 BCE, and the pharaohs Seti I around 1300 BCE and Ramses IV around 1300 107 BCE, and were recently discovered on the pre-Ptolemaic monuments excavated in the Mediterranean of Alexandria, each of the Decans, probably beginning with Sirius, was invisible for 70 days and was given a 100-day period of special significance, a decade. Following its period of invisibility and revert from the Duat, to reduce the Decans to maritime keepers is to obscure their significance and thought. And there is no reason to doubt the literal claim that a star dies and a star lives every 10 days. To measure time was to observe the endless drama of death and resurrection, of life and immortality, the endless alternating triumph of darkness and light. Collectively, they appear to have been arranged in a band which appears to have been just south of the ecliptic, the sun's apparent path through the sky, since they were led by Isis, who was associated with Sirius, on a path set out by Re. There were 12 decans visible in the course of one night. The origin of our 12 hours. In all of the texts, none of which survives from earlier than the New Kingdom, which documents the sun's nocturnal journey through the Duat, it is divided into 12 regions, and it is tempting to speculate that it is a special analog of the 12-month year. In this sense, the decans have been compared to a Christian Advent calendar, marking the time until the triumphant reappearance of Sirius. These are reasonable assumptions, although the texts do not tell us this. The earliest reference to hours occurs in the very first pyramid text from Una's pyramid, in which we are told that the sun clears the night and dispatches the hours. It is likely that the Decan system evolved from direct observation of stellar rising to more systematized measurements of equal periods, hinted at in the tomb of the official Amenemhet in the reign of Amenhotep, who has been called the first astronomer we can name in ancient Egypt. Certainly, we know that mechanical clocks were being invented. The early surviving water clock dates from the reign of Amenhotep III. One outstanding question is the extent to which Egyptian astronomy was influenced by the other Near Eastern cultures. The problem, though, may be a consequence of the sheer lack of source material. It is inconceivable that the Egyptian priests had no access in the second millennium to the knowledge and systems of Mesopotamia, and the use of the 36 stars by both cultures suggests a common origin in the third millennium or earlier. It is just not realistic to assume that the cultures which traded in artifacts never came into contact with each other's ideas. The Greeks were later to borrow 12-hour nights from the Egyptians, sexagesimal counting from the Babylonians, and bequeath us our modern day of 24 60-minute hours. It seems likely that the 36 decans may have been represented especially in the Egyptian state, as well as in the sky In the 5th century, the Greek historian Herodotus tells us that Egyptian Mediterranean coast was exactly 3,600 stades, 420 miles in length. Herodotus also tells us that during the reign of the 12 kings, a memorial had been constructed featuring a sacred lake, Lake Moeris, the circumference of which was 3,600 stades. The lake was positioned next to the labyrinth of 12 covered courts, 6 of which faced south and 6 of which faced north, and contained in its center 2 pyramids, each of 600 feet high, each high as did the Pyramid of Cheops. Their volume will be 72 million square. Similar fashion to the pyramids, half of which were submerged below the sacred lake, connecting underworld to overworld. Given that Herodotus' information about former times is often wrong, he may nevertheless have been reporting a genuine belief in his time that earthly mansions mirrored celestial ones. The early surviving complete catalogue of the universe was compiled around 1100 BCE by Amenope, a scribe of sacred books in the House of Life. He intended it to comprise everything made up of heaven, with its affairs, earth, and what is in it, what the mountains belch forth, what is watered by the flood, all things upon which Re has shone, all that is grown on the back of the earth. Amenope began his catalogue with sky, followed by sun, moon, and star. He then listed in 5 constellations, only 2 of which can be identified. We can identify Sa, Orion, a man running while looking over his shoulder, from the characteristic 3-star of its belt, which figures on Osiris' crown, Mishtui or Meshitu, the 7 stars of the Big Dipper, which the Egyptians saw as an ox leg, or the sometimes as a whole bull. The Amenope mentions neither any other constellation nor planet has been used to suggest that such celestial affairs may have been of far less importance to the ancient Egyptian than the terrestrial matters which he has intimately involved with. However, the fact that he also ignores Sirius's suggests that either the catalogue is incomplete, but that Amenope's possible personal disinterest in the sky was not representative of Egyptian culture as a whole. You are listening Egypt, the Stars and the Soul, from History of Western Astrology, from Nicholas Campion. This was Brandalism, every second Friday of the month. Join us next Brandalism on December, the second Friday of the month, and we will continue with the subjects of the Stars and the Soul from the Western Astrology. Enjoy your lovely evening.